You're listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story. From Darwin, Australia, this is your host, Lucy Van Sambeek. Hello, my guest this week on Talk the Walk is Emily Harpier. Emily graduated from the University of Queensland in 2009 after completing her final placement and staying on to work at Kamara Indigenous Family Support Service in Brisbane. Emily shortly after moved to Cairns and worked for the Royal Flying Doctor Service as a clinical counsellor who was contracted to work at new wellbeing centres in four Cape York welfare reform communities, including Arakoon and Mossman Gorge. Emily has worked for 5 years in an Indigenous women's health accommodation service with mothers at risk of having their newborn babies removed by the Child Safety Department. She was also involved in a local action group to establish a hub to help remote community members access much-needed medical services. Welcome, Emily, and I'm so glad you could fit this conversation into your busy schedule.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
As I was doing this introduction, Emily, I was wondering what kind of memories might have been coming back for you of this time that you've worked out in Aboriginal communities. Is there one particular memory that kind of stands out to you as you think back on what you've achieved so far in your career?
I was thinking about working at Kamara, actually, when you brought that up, because that's been a long time. The CEO there is Gerald Heatherstone, who's another EQ social work graduate, and he was a wonderful first mentor, a Bundjalung man. And, yeah, he was just a great boss, excellent management, and I'm just thinking sometimes you don't really realise how good a workplace is until you leave it. But, you know, I moved, so I couldn't have kept working there from Cairns, unfortunately. That was a wonderful service.
So what was it about your time at Kamara that, was really special to you, or what stood out for you for your work there or your learnings in that place?
I had some really good experienced workers around me at Kamara who had worked with Aboriginal people for a long time. Most of them were Aboriginal, in fact, and there was really good training there as well. Gerald is quite close with Paul Harnett, who's one of the writers of the Parents Under Pressure program out of UQ. And there was also some other training, which I can't remember the name of, for working with families. That was Paul and Gerald worked on adapting that for working with Aboriginal families. And I learned a lot about Aboriginal families involved in the child protection system at that time and became quite passionate about it because there's certainly institutional racism present in the system. Just the numbers speak for themselves there, really. And I see the rate of removal as a continuation of the stolen generation. And because of my sense of justice, I just feel very passionately about that. And even when I've sort of tried to move away from the area of Indigenous child protection, I always seem to end up back there involved somehow. And, you know, the only reason I try and move away is normally because I'm emotionally exhausted, but fate always leads me back, it seems. Mm-hmm. So I guess I can thank Kamara for starting me on that journey. Mm. And, thank that workplace for just being wonderful and a great starting off point. And I'd really love to work there again if I ever went back to Brisbane.
Yeah, right. I'm wondering if I can take you back a bit earlier than that, Emily. You speak mm-hmm. of a sense of justice, and I'm wondering, is that something that's been around for a while, or can you pinpoint a time or a place where that sense of justice first started for you?
Yes, well, I can probably thank my parents for, you know, certainly not being racist themselves and really instilling in me that it's wrong to be racist. And look, they're still a product of their generation, but maybe a bit ahead of their time in some ways. I remember when I was in grade one, this is at Clermont State School, which is an hour north of Emerald. We were being taught history, and I was asking, well, what happened before Captain Cook arrived? Because, of course, that's where it starts. And then, of course, they told us the myth of peaceful settlement as well. So I went home and I asked, I remember asking my dad about it, and he was saying, no, well, you know, Aboriginal people were here. They were here for 40,000 years and, you know, they did fight back. So, you know, he knew that peaceful settlement at least was a myth. And so then I kind of, I don't, I just have that memory, which is why I'm bringing it up. And then I also remember we went to Woorabinda when I was about 15 or 16, visiting some friends who were working there. And I was kind of, I think part of me was sort of excited to think that I would see Aboriginal people living on their own land. Like, I was quite misguided in my thoughts. I guess I'd made assumptions that in my mind were fair. And then I saw the state of things, I suppose, is the only way to put it. And I was quite disturbed. And I was asking someone about the area, the community, and how it came to be. And someone, this was a white man, said, oh, well, someone was nice enough to give them this area to live in. And I just was thinking at the time, what? That doesn't make any sense. This is their land. Yeah, so I suppose it's little things like that from childhood and growing up. Yeah, and I just had this really overwhelming sense of injustice, I suppose. And also like a, I don't know, I was kind of drawn to Aboriginal people and Aboriginal culture or something like that. Hopefully that doesn't sound too fetishizing or something. you know, I don't want to go the other way either. I'm trying to be awarely racist because I certainly believe it's not really possible as a white person to be brought up in Australia and not be racist, because it's just the way our society is and we're conditioned by that. And so the best we can really hope to be is awarely racist, just become more aware of our own racism, try to counteract it, work against it, educate ourselves all the time. Yeah, so that's probably a bit about that sense of justice.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, are there other beliefs or values or knowledge that you hold as really important in your work?
Well, I suppose there's, you know, that equality of all human beings, and probably aligns to the ASW code of ethics and the values that inform that. So, you know, human dignity and worth.
This sense of equality and human dignity, would you say these are a product of your early life as well, or how did probably these values come to be?
I'd say that's just from my parenting and, yeah, more than anything else.
So tell me about your parents. What kind of people were they? What did they teach you? What influence have they had on you?
They're definitely they love people, and they're they love other people, talking to people, learning about them, hearing everything they got to say. They're both able to challenge their perspectives, look at things from someone else's point of view, I guess. And I'm like that as well. You know, I just love meeting new people and finding out everything about them. You know, if I meet someone new, I'll ask them everything about them. And I'm just really interested in people, and I suppose too, they're quite compassionate in that they can always try and understand why someone, I guess if someone's not acting nice towards them or to me, you know, as a child, if I come, oh, so-and-so is doing this, well, you don't know what's going on for them at home, or, you know, just having that compassion for other people, which I think, and giving people the benefit of the doubt, I suppose. And I've really got that, and it's made me quite interested. You know, I guess it's part of the reason I'm a social worker. I'm interested in why things are the way they are, honestly, and why people are the way they are and how they came to be that way. I think you can understand a lot about a person. Oh, looking at someone's family of origin is part of my framework for practice for counselling, for adults anyway, and it sort of comes with the territory for children. And with that comes theories about intergenerational trauma, which I guess for me aren't theories, they're the truth.
So speaking about your framework for practice, how would you describe it?
Well, it's a hard one to pin down, that one. When I first graduated, it was quite clear and I actually got permission from an Aboriginal artist to use a painting. It was an artwork that they had up at Kamara, and I contacted the artist and asked if I could use it, explain what I was doing. Just because it had, I thought, because I was planning on practicing in the Indigenous context, I thought, you know, using a Indigenous painting would be apt. And it had levels that meant different things in there, and they kind of represented my different skills, knowledge and values and methods and processes and that sort of stuff. So I'm trying to think back to that, but it's definitely changed. It might even be worth doing again if I could ever find the time. Maybe at work I could do it for some CPE hours or something. I guess the main things, I'm very trauma-informed. Judy Atkinson, Professor Judy Atkinson, who's an Aboriginal woman, she's written a book called Trauma Trails, which is excellent. It just explains everything so well. And
it's
then
a wonderful book, yeah.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And, you know, even going back to trying to think, you know, codependence, those type of theories, and some of the methods and processes that come out of that, including like basic psychotherapy, that sort of thing, are really ring true for me and seem to work, I suppose, like if I have that as a framework anyway. And yeah, that probably really does influence. Well, I guess it's such a wide-ranging idea. It comes through a lot of methods and processes. But for me, I guess it's one that's often on my mind, so that would mean that it's part of my framework.
Can you explain what you mean by codependence theories?
Well, codependence first came about as a term to describe the way that the partner of an alcoholic or an addict, so they can sort of act like they're addicted to trying to control the alcoholic's drinking or the addict's using or whatever it is. But that has come to mean a lot more broad dysfunctional family behaviors, I suppose, than just that. And it's like being addicted to dysfunctional personal relationships. That addiction theory, like I've done a bit of drug and alcohol counseling, and I'm very interested in that area. Yeah, so that really informs my practice framework as well. Addiction theory and stages of change comes into that. Yeah, I guess people can be so used to trying to help their mother that they can't stop it, and I guess it's almost like an addiction. Yeah, an addiction to dysfunctional personal relationships, and there's so many behaviors that go along with that. So when it gets down to the nitty-gritty, it's about being able to identify all of those things and give people other options as well. We're talking, you know, practical day-to-day stuff. Yeah.
Sure. It might be good at this point in time for you to give us a little bit of an idea on the work that you've been doing since you graduated those many years ago. And yeah, I guess how you've developed this framework practice over the years, because you've been doing quite a few different things, haven't you?
So when I was working at Kamara still, there was a few projects going there, but one of the things was working with families involved with the child protection system. So they would either have their children removed and be trying to get them back, or be on an intervention with parental agreement, which in Queensland is like, if you don't do these things, we will take your kids, I suppose, is the layman's way of describing that. It's apparently voluntary, but if you don't sign it, you're going to get your kids taken off you. So that doesn't really make sense. So relationship building is pretty hard when you're working with statutory clients. So that's really good practice. And then, you know, you've got to, and at that time I wasn't a parent myself. I'm like this 25 or something, 26, 25, trying to work with parents and, you know, say that these are the things that child safety wants you to do. But I suppose in that context, you know, I was like, well, what's your goal? And they'd be saying, I want child safety out of my life. I said, well, this is what they're saying you need to do. Here's how I can help you do that. And is there anything else you want to do for yourself? And that's very much case management stuff, as well as interventions like group attendance, a bit of counselling, that sort of thing. So But, yeah, you know, really making a plan and figuring out exactly all the steps and all the different services involved, referrals need to be made, all that kind of thing. And advocacy is a big part, was a big part of that role. Really, you know, learning how to write a good report and how to show child safety, I guess, what parents have been doing, and word it in a way that they understand. So it's almost like you've got to be able to speak one language to engage with the parents and to do all the work with them, and then speak another language to be able to talk to child safety and use the words that they need to hear for their legal requirements and all that kind of thing. So there's a lot of learning there. And then after that is when I went to Arakoon. And that was, they just started the, oh, it was a couple of years in, maybe 1 year in, to the welfare reform. So that was a multifaceted idea of Noel Pearson's, and four KPO communities signed up for it, which was Mosman Gorge, Arakoon, Cowan, and what was the other one? Hope Vale. So I worked in Arakoon and a little bit in Mosman Gorge at times. So what happened with that was there was a lot of funding put in. You know, it was great that they built these wellbeing centres, but they also had these family responsibilities commissions, which was made up of local elders and other respected communities, but a local group. And then people could be referred to them through a number of streams, which was housing. So if they got some kind of black mark from housing or something, they'd have to go there, child safety, criminal justice system, or the schools, which would usually be about attendance. And so then we'd get all these mandatory clients, you know, who'd gotten drunk and disorderly or something. And so then they'd have to come to the wellbeing centre to complete an alcohol program. And then we'd have to report back to the FRC, as it was called, Family Responsibilities Commission, about their attendance and what modules they completed, this sort of thing. Yeah, so that was about, you know, we also had voluntary clients, which was good. You know, with any statutory group that's other than child safety, I think people are a bit more pressed in that instance. Engagements, well, it's just a mixed bag and it's difficult. But, you know, there's certainly great that all of those wellbeing centres got built and they've been staffed, and there's been some really good programs that have come from that. And they have advisory groups, which is kind of like a local board for all of those wellbeing centres, and they would tell us workers what was needed and what they wanted. So even though we had this statutory element, we did have a lot of freedom as well to, you know, do groups or, you know, see individuals or whatever else needed to happen. Yeah.
We'll speak a little bit more about the challenges and struggles that you might have had along the way. But after that, you went to the Indigenous Women's Health Foundation Service, is that right?
Yes, yes. So that's Mukai Rosie Bibine, and it's a unique service in Australia. Sometimes people contact them and ask them about it because I think they're thinking of setting one up, you know, in other parts of the country. But so far, I think Mukai Rosie, well, that's what we call it for short, or Mukai for short, is the only one. Mukai Rosie Bibine means Auntie Rosie's place in Kukuyalanji language. Auntie Rosie is the lady who started it, Auntie Rose Richards, and she was working as an Aboriginal liaison officer at the Cairns Hospital, and she was actually bringing patients into her own home to help them with the follow-up treatment. And in the end, she got funding, and first, I believe, they had a place in Grafton Street in Cairns, and then one out at the Northern Beaches they called the Farm, Rosie's Farm, and then in Earlville, and now it's a purpose-built facility out of Edmonton. So it's been going for 30 years. And what it does, it's kind of like a Ronald McDonald House, I guess, from Cape York, Torres Strait Gulf, who need to travel to Cairns for medical or perinatal care. So in these small remote communities, they can't get imaging done, can't see a specialist, can't give birth. Well, I suppose they could, but, you know, there's no birthing facilities.
What was your role in that service? What were the things that you were doing?
I was the first, they got funding for a counsellor in 2010. I was the first counsellor there. And so I was just seeing anyone really who wanted counselling. And then in the end, we ended up with a lot of women who child safety were giving them their notification, they'd given birth and then removing the baby from the hospital and that type of thing. And we would say, oh, what if they stay at Mukai for 3 months? Marrying education, parenting programs, they can do their counselling if it's DV, drug and alcohol, whatever. And, you know, so it was really very community driven. It's never been funded by the Department of Child Safety, and that's been purposeful. So in the end, that was such full-on work that we only ended up taking 2 child safety long stays at a time. Right. And also child safety became part of the screening process, so we'd know before they got there, although they don't always know. And then in the end also, because it's a health, you know, the counselling is just a small part of the overall picture. The really great thing about Mukai Rosie is that it's a culturally safe place for people to come and stay when they're in a different town because they've got to get medical treatment, which is all pretty scary. And it's got Aboriginal health workers there 24/7, so there's always 2 people there. So as part of, so they're looking after all their health needs, and as part of their assessment or needs analysis they do when people first arrive, it was actually the counsellor who came after me, Renee Hine, who implemented this screening tool, just about 5 questions, so that we were screening people for self-harm and suicidal ideation for one, and then, you know, if they might like to see a counsellor. So the referrals for counselling came through the health workers. And I've also been the health team leader there as well. I've also got a degree in biomedical science, and I've worked as an assistant nurse. And, yeah.
Wow. That would have been very handy in that environment.
Yeah. And, yeah, I'm quite comfortable with the whole health field. Mm. It's not really foreign to me. So, you know, it can be for people who aren't used to it, like some social work students. If they go to a health placement, they say, oh, it's like another language. There's all these acronyms. There's all these terms and stuff. And luckily I sort of had that knowledge already. So that makes it a bit easier working in a health context.
So can you talk about, I guess, some of the outcomes that you might have been achieving through that new service? Because it sounds like it would have been quite rewarding for you in that being an early intervention, prevention kind of service, you're actually stopping children from being removed from their families.
Yeah, absolutely. It's amazing. It's such a good service, and it's actually named now. It's called the Mums and Bubs Together program because they're doing a, is it called Together or Families Together? They actually kept their old premises at Balaclava Road, at Earlville, and they've got funding now for that program, basically just to expand. And that will include not just, you know, mums and newborns, which is all we've really been doing, but, you know, whole families and people with older children and, you know, different circumstances. The health service, Mukai Rosie B. Byrne, is women only. So, you know, the dads were never part of the Mums and Bubs Together program. But this new program, yeah, will include all that. So that's very exciting.
if you think about, I guess, some of the sparkling moments or success stories or achievements for you, what stands out?
I guess even if I remember running into a lady one day who had been at Mukai, and I didn't know if she got her other kids back or, you know, she was able to keep her baby after she left and that kind of thing. And, you know, she said, oh, I've got all my kids back now, and we've got a house, and, you know, and it's that kind of stuff is just amazing. Yeah.
Thinking back to your work in Cape York, I imagine that was quite challenging in that it was fairly new, groundbreaking stuff that Noel Pearson was doing. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about, I guess, what might have been the challenges or struggles that you faced there?
Well, I just graduated. It was just full on. It was like being thrown in the deep end, I tell you what. And things are very different working with Indigenous people from mainstream for a lot of reasons. And I guess I loved it in Aurukun though. And One of the things I did, which was actually really good for relationship building, was I asked permission to learn Wik'mungkan, which is the language they speak there. And, you know, people were so happy and so generous with their knowledge. And, you know, a lot of people helped me learn that. Mm. I mean, I can't speak it very well. I can just say, like, you know, how are you going? Where are you going? What's talk about the weather? And I learned to talk about feelings and and, you know, names for family members and that kind of stuff, because that's important to my work.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just even some of the things like, so everyone knows if someone comes to the wellbeing centre, because they see them. And it wasn't the done thing there to make an appointment and for people to show up at that time. You'd go and find them, which to me, I was like, oh my God, confidentiality. But it was it was just what you did. And then you'd ask them if they want to come to the wellbeing centre. And if they say after or later, they say after instead of later, that means no. But if they do come, then they come. And I remember talking to another social worker who was like, she was pretty big on narrative therapy. And, yeah, actually that's part of my practice framework as well. I didn't sort of realize, and I had to learn a lot about trauma really quickly, because there's some severely traumatized people and it changes everything. It changes just like basic stuff like sensory processing and memory and things we take for granted, like having like a clear timeline of our life, which is also quite a Western view anyway, that linear time thing. Oh, it's just there's so many cultural differences. And so she advised me, like, try and do your session as if it's going to be the only one, which was great advice, because you're not taught that at uni.
That's interesting.
You do this thing and next thing you know, so just try and get as much as you can out of one session, because it might be the only one. And that was a really good piece of advice. And, you know, with not knowing things and doing all the cultural faux pas and all this kind of stuff, you know, I'm good at reading people's nonverbal cues anyway, but nonverbal cues were bigger there than they are in what, you know, what white Australian culture, I suppose. And, you know, if I noticed, if I was getting a nonverbal cue that someone, that I'd offended someone somehow, I'd just straight up say, look, what have I done wrong? You know, I've offended you. How have I done it? Please, can you tell me? And if they'd tell me what I'd done, and I'd say, oh, thank you so much. You know, I really appreciate you didn't have to share that with me, but that's really helpful. You know, I'm going to be able to not do that again with anyone else. And all those kinds of things.
So it sounds like in some ways you described it as being thrown in the deep end.
Yeah.
That you really rose to the challenge.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not a long-term thing. I worked there for a year and then I went away for a bit and then I went back again for 6 months. And it's just, I mean, the staff turnover is very high. Well, it was anyway. So obviously everyone's finding it challenging. And there's even just the challenge of being a fly-in, fly-out worker. Yeah, so there's lots of lifestyle challenges and it's just so different. It's like another country, especially when people are speaking another language as well. And, yeah, so I don't know if anyone's ever – people have travelled and even like being in a place – when there's lots of little things that are different from your usual culture, it's kind of like it's really exhausting. Yeah.
What would have made it easier for you, do you think?
I did have, you know, especially actually my – that's how I met Renee Hine, the one who was saying develop the screening tool at Mukai Rosie Bivine. She was my team leader at Arakoon for a bit and then I ended up being her team leader at Mukai. But having that close – because we're quite close friends, but that's how we met. Having a good friend there and, you know, they do look after their workers, the Royal Flying Doctor Service thing would be preparation, you know. I'm pretty open-minded and adaptable, but not everyone is. You just can't expect that from people if they're not really sure what to expect. They did give us cultural education and stuff and induction and everything, of course. I don't even know if there's anything that can prepare you. And so, I think the type of person who goes into that type of situation is the type of person who educates themselves on it anyway, or has some kind of life experience that will equip them for that.
So it sounds like mentors were really important to you, Renee being one.
Yes.
Are there any other kind of mentors or people that have helped you along the way?
Uncle Jonathan Corkectane, he was one of our local workers at the, I don't think he still works there, at the Wellbeing Centre in Arakoon. He's a wonderful man. Yeah, and there was a late auntie who was, she wasn't, she was just a member of the community, and I was quite close with her and her daughter. She was a really lovely woman and she taught me lots of language. And honestly, I'd say the whole community of Arakoon is just, they're so lovely and welcoming and generous. Yeah.
So how important was it to have people like the auntie and uncle that you mentioned too?
Oh, it's absolutely imperative. I mean, you can't do that stuff without the support of elders and community members. It's just impossible.
Can you describe what your relationship was like and how that worked?
Well, I guess I just came from a place of as best I could, of humility and respect. You know, there's just so much that I didn't know. And I really do feel grateful for how generous people are in sharing their cultural knowledge. You know, it's not, sometimes people kind of expect it, job. So when people do it, being grateful for that is really important.
I'm aware that you've worked not only in Indigenous communities in Australia, but also mainstream contexts. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about what you think the differences are, what you do differently, or what you think or find is different between the two contexts of work.
Yeah, I've just been working in mainstream for 5 months now as a counsellor, so it's completely different. You know, there's a lot more community engagement is important. Was important at Mukai Rosie and in Arakoon, just talking to everyone, getting to know everyone and really trying to understand everything I can about the community as a whole. Whereas now, I mean, I've got clients now who are from different cultural backgrounds, and I obviously find out what I can about those as well. But I have a lot of mainstream clients. And, you know, I just have 4-hour, 1-hour appointments a day, and they come in, you know, it's very time structured, I suppose, is one big difference.
Mm-hmm.
And the CPE even that I do, continuing professional education is very structured as well. You know, I read this, I watch this thing online, I go to this training. Whereas I did obviously do those things as well before, but some of it was just walking around, talking to people, going to community group events and stuff is all part of working with Indigenous people and being there, being a presence and being seen, getting to know people. Yeah, and I guess that's not really part of my job now, which is totally different, yeah.
Are there parts of your old work that you miss or...?
Yeah, definitely. Look, I wasn't really looking to change because I was very happy at Mukai, but I did see this job and I thought, oh, I wouldn't mind that job, I'll just go for it because it probably suits my life for me now a bit better because I've got a 3.5-year-old and I'm split up from his father. So I can get very emotional with the advocacy side of things, and doing straight counselling now, there's not much advocacy. There is a bit. I still have, you know, clients from marginalised groups, including Indigenous people. If I work with child safety, it's with the children and I'm counselling them rather than the mothers. Oh, no, I've got one parent too, actually, who's involved. Yeah, so... So I just miss the clients, but, you know, I've got new great clients now as well. I miss being, you know, part of the community or, you know, in the community. Yeah. But, you know, there's good things about this new job and it just suits my lifestyle a bit better at this point in my life. But I definitely think that I will go back to working with Indigenous people at some point.
So you've spoken a fair bit about, you know, the various challenges that you've faced along the way. And I'm wondering, what skills or knowledge do you have now that you wouldn't have had if you hadn't faced those challenges? Can you speak about those? What you've got in your practice framework now that you wouldn't have had?
I think definitely being, just becoming more aware of my own biases. The easiest, you know, if we're part of the dominant culture and also that's all we ever experience, it's really difficult to see what's cultural and what's real and sort of what's getting right back into being very philosophical, what's constructed and what isn't. And, you know, so being able to see some of that stuff, which they, you know, definitely pressed at uni as well. I guess that's, you know, probably the thing I value the most, being completely selfish. You know, it's like mind opening, and I'm able to see the world differently. Yeah.
For people that are listening that perhaps don't work with Indigenous communities or with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, what would be a piece of advice or some learnings that you might pass on to them?
Don't take for granted the teaching that people give you about their culture. You know, really appreciate that. They don't have to do it. And just educate yourself. Read everything. Find out everything. There's, you know, we're really denied a lot of information. We certainly have been historically. A really good book is Why Weren't We Told by Henry Reynolds. That's an excellent book. Just to, he's a historian, and he believed the myth of peaceful settlement, and that was what was written down. And he went through all the newspapers, and, you know, because everything that happened was just there in black and white, and was like, this isn't even, there's all this evidence that this isn't what happened. And he, you know, talks about how we've just completely just tried to deny our true history, and it's not helping anyone. It's harming everyone in this country, not just Indigenous people. It's obviously harming them the most, but it's not, you know, that comes, I guess that's my codependency framework coming out again. Denial, you know, secrets keep you sick. So we're all sick with this denial around our true history. And what really troubles me as well is that people just don't want to be racist. So if they get their racism pointed out to them, they just say, well, they just go straight to saying, I'm not racist. It's like, people have just got to become okay with being racist. If we all just accept we're all racist, then we can move forward. And look, it's great that people don't want to be racist. That's a really good thing. But now it seems to me that it's at the point where it's actually stopping people from learning and overcoming it. We don't just get to decide that we're not racist. You know, if someone from another race is telling us we're being racist, we're being racist.
It's like, you don't know what you don't know until you know.
Yes, but maybe it's the English culture, you know, we were colonized by them, that it's not okay to not know. We're supposed to know everything already.
Well, that sounds like really good advice. Do you have any other favorite authors that you might recommend to people listening?
Arnie Jackie Huggins as well. Yes. She's got some great stuff. The other thing, I'll just add this because it is quite important, is being confronted as a white person. I can, if I go to this mainstream job now, I can forget, if I want, that racism exists towards Indigenous people in this country. I can just go to my job, I can come home, I'm not well, my son's Indigenous, so it's a bit different now, but I could, you know, before. And I actually, you know, that stuff of, you know, then I'm suddenly dealing with racism every day because it's part of my client's everyday life. So then it's, you know, coming into my everyday work. And it's just, it was really heartbreaking, I suppose. And one thing that black people have, and this is probably one of the, I mean, they're the most suited to working with Indigenous people, but also they have the resilience because they're already used to dealing with racism on a daily basis. And look, I think Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are the most resilient people on earth, probably. Absolutely. So that can be very, very wearing. Yeah, and that resilience. I never want to be, if there's a line where on one side you care too little, on the other side you care too much, and I'm trying to get somewhere and like right on the line, but that's quite a hard place to get to because it's only a thin line. I'd rather be on the side that cares a little bit too much, but that can take its toll. And, yeah, you know, that's where, you know, again, Indigenous people are just so generous with how they're resilient, their resilience around that stuff, and their passion too is what keeps Indigenous services going and keeps, and, you know, I guess I'm being pretty selfish, you know, thinking about how hard it is for, you know, these non-Indigenous workers to suddenly have to develop this resilience that Indigenous people already have, which for a horrible reason.
And when you were talking about that line and not being too far on one side or the other, I kind of had the image in my mind. I was thinking about, well, Aboriginal people's experience is kind of walking a fine line too, isn't it, between two worlds?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So we're trying to meet halfway. Well, I've really enjoyed our time talking tonight. I'm wondering, just in finishing up, could you share, I guess, some future hopes or dreams that you might have? You've talked a lot about the values that you bring to your work, a sense of justice and equality particularly. Going forward, what's the picture look like for you?
If I could just wave a magic wand, I'd like to just be able to take away everyone's defensiveness around. And I think that people don't want to see our true history because of the grief it will bring. And, you know, a lot of my practice framework, again, is around just fear of feelings, which a lot of people have. So there's a lot, it's avoidance of grief, all this denial and stuff. But it's just so important. We can't actually have all the grief until it's all acknowledged. And so that all needs to happen. But as for my personal work, I guess what I'd like to see in Cairns is this idea of the hub, which is a little group that I was involved with. It's very early stages, trying to get together a hub for people who travel down to Cairns for health reasons. Not all of them stay at Mukairosi, which, you know, makes sure they get to their appointments and gives them any health education they might need. Lots of people stay at hotels. And, you know, it can be pretty confusing trying to navigate the health system, get around, meet appointments, all that kind of stuff. So I think they have one of these in the Northern Territory maybe. And it's just a central point where people can go for help with their health travel, really. So I'd like to see that happen in Cairns.
Beautiful. Sounds like a good dream to work towards. I'll see what I can do in terms of magic wands. And send one down to you.
Don't all social workers have a magic wand?
Apparently. Well, thank you, Emily, again. I really appreciate you taking time out to have this conversation with me. I know we've been trying to do it for a couple of weeks and we finally connected. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me. Lovely to talk to you.
Thanks for listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story, music by Flashback Digital. You can access all the show notes from today's podcast at www.metaphoricallyspeaking.com.au. I'm currently on the lookout for inspiring interviewees. If you or someone you know is walking the talk in their work or community, then I'd love to hear from you. You can drop me an email at lucy@metaphoricallyspeaking.com.au or visit my contact page on the Metaphorically Speaking website. Until next time, just keep on walking.